The Conspiracy of Lemurs, a Regal House publishing podcast that celebrates the writing craft. Co-hosted by myself, Janie Royal, founder and editor-in-chief at Regal House Publishing, and the editorial marvel, Pam Van Dyke, Regal's managing editor. We are thrilled today to welcome two of our Regal House authors, Lila Lawson and Melanie Cosey, to explore themes of mental illness in Victorian and Southern Gothic literature. But before we get into the madness, and I can promise there will be little method in it, Pam, would you care to introduce our guests?
Sure, I would be delighted. Lila Lawson's debut novel, Monarchs Under the Sassafras Tree, was published in September of 2019 through Regal House Publishing. Her dark fantasy, Dead Rock Star, will be published in November of 2020 through Parliament House Press and will be followed with a sequel, The Wolf Den. Happiest when straddling literary genres, Lila enjoys writing both historical fiction and what she calls nerdy noir. Melanie Cosey writes in the fiction genres of gothic horror, historical, magical realism, paranormal, and women's fiction, and she has written on a wide variety of nonfiction topics. She is also a poet. Melanie's love of the Victorian period and unsettling stories inspire her tales of gothic horror. Her debut gothic horror novel, A Peculiar Curiosity, was published in 2018 by Regal House. Melanie's short stories can be found in several anthologies, including Quoth, The Raven, and Love Among the Thorns, both edited by Lynn Worthen. Melanie belongs to the Horror Writers Association, is an editor, and teaches writing on Vancouver Island. So, Janie, can you tell us a little bit more about what we're going to talk about today?
Sure. I have to admit, I have been eagerly awaiting this podcast episode. I have long been an avid reader of Gothic fiction, of both the English and American variety, and Anne Radcliffe, who might well be called the first great practitioner of the Gothic novel, as well as the most popular and best paid of all 18th century English novelists, established what are today recognizable Gothic tropes, such as psychological and physical terror, evocative, moody landscapes, mystery in the supernatural, doubling and hereditary curses, and of course, madness. What's not to love, right? So let's leap into the fray, shall we? Pam, I believe the first question is all yours.
Oh, fantastic. Well, given what you've just told our listeners about Gothic literature, I want to pose a question to Lila and Melanie and ask you as writers, given what Janie has just described as the tropes in Gothic literature, how have those things influenced your work? And Lila, we'll start with you.
Well, Southern Gothic in particular is interesting because it encapsulates so many different things within the genre. As far as it pertains to my own work, I've been very inspired by writers like Erskine Caldwell, Flannery O'Connor, who are both from Georgia as well. And they write about madness in a way that is particularly, I don't like to say funny, but has like a vein of humor in it. And I'm very drawn to that particular type of Southern Gothic writing that has just a little bit of, I don't know, what you might call the ludicrousness of it. And there's also a lot of depravity, greed, dealing with lives that are laced with poverty and things of that nature. All of that inspires me a great deal.
Fantastic.
Well, I write specifically in the Victorian Gothic. So I'm really drawn to the atmospheric of the castles, the crumbling manor, and where it concerns, of course, madness. I also find that fascinating. The whole descent into madness is what I like to write about. Gothic literature does this. Rather than taking the specific sort of more chemistry of mental illness, it tends to focus on a tipping point that's external. So I'm kind of fascinated by that. So that's what I like to write about.
So that's a great segue, Melanie, into really talking about what the Victorian and or pre-World War II Southern view of madness or mental illness comprised as it pertained to men and to women. And why was it such a topic of fascination in literature at the time?
The reason that they did like to write about it, because not much was known about it, and it was sort of this vague thing that could happen to you. There was many reasons why, and nothing was really concrete. So it was always sort of this dark thing that would hang over your shoulder. Things that were considered to be, you know, insane or mad are not things that we would consider today, you know, such as postpartum depression, homosexuality, even promiscuity. If you veered off the sort of straight and narrow, you were seen as insane. So it's kind of interesting that that would get put into the literature.
And I'm assuming that women were primarily the recipients of these kinds of labeling.
Oh, for sure.
I think, too, just to follow up on what you mentioned, Melanie, it is interesting that this ended up in the literature because there was a time, I think, when women had no power really at all in terms of their own health and well-being. And sometimes it was often a husband or a father who might commit a young woman to an institution because, as you say, she was behaving in ways that fell outside of the realm of what he considered normal. And so in your opinion, how do you think these real things happening at the time eventually ended up translated into works of fiction?
I think it was mainly because it was a great catalyst for fear, and fear makes a great story. So if you look at some of the earlier ones like Frankenstein, where Frankenstein, the Dr. Frankenstein, not the monster, was sort of seen as insane to be toying with science, you know, and making this creature that was out of, you know, parts of real humans, which is another theme in Gothic, is that it takes sort of the science of the time and views it sort of moralistically. Like, how far can we take science before it's immoral? You know, how much are we sort of crossing the line between what should be left up to God and, you know, what is okay for us as humans to delve into, which is something that A Peculiar Curiosity also looks into. The science, where does the science divide from the morals?
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting, too, that a lot of these early prominent writers in Gothic literature, at least insofar as the English tradition is concerned, were female. And that surely by writing these narratives, you know, that is a process of empowerment as well. And as you say, Melanie, with Mary Shelley and Frankenstein, it is interesting that it is a woman who is asking these questions at that time.
Yeah, Lila, did you have something, did you want to follow up on that?
For one thing, I wanted to mention what Melanie just pointed out about the crumbling of manners, what she said a while ago about Victorian Gothic. I think it's interesting that with Southern Gothic, which is kind of categorized as being post-Civil War, sort of when that genre ramped up, I've often heard people talk about the crumbling of the plantation as being kind of our version of Gothic, which I find really interesting because it's all about the crumbling of a way of life, which wasn't necessarily a good way of life. But I just find that interesting that we kind of take the Southern plantation and sort of compare it to a crumbling manor as it pertains to Victorian Gothic. But also, as far as the mental health struggles of people in the Southern Gothic period, that's definitely true for us as well. A lot of women back during that time period that suffered from things that seem kind of basic to us now, such as postnatal depression or just anxiety disorders, were often committed or put into asylums by, as you said, their husbands or other family members that were male who just didn't understand what they were dealing with. And a lot of the times, you know, what we saw back then as madness or hysteria was really just very real mental health problems that might have been solved quite easily if they were in another time period.
You know, it makes me think of the conclusion of A Streetcar Named Desire, where Blanche is, you know, carted off by state hospital staff and threatened with a straitjacket. And she epitomizes the dangers that mental instability poses for those among us that are unprotected. And I think that this is also beautifully portrayed in your novel, Lila, where Civi, the protagonist of Monarchs Under the Sassafras Tree, is incarcerated in Milledgeville Asylum after she suffers a breakdown following the death of her child. And the question, of course, for Civi's husband and for the reader is whether or not Civi is irretrievably mad or whether her subsequent incarceration stems from her community sense that she has somehow stepped beyond the bounds of propriety. Women were often, as you mentioned, described as hysterical because they didn't follow the accepted gender role that society had defined for them. So are these characters, Sibby included, crazy, or has society labeled them such in the hopes of maintaining control and order, an order which, of course, is imposed by a male patriarchy? And where in Gothic literature do the lines of real mental illness and convenient misdiagnoses cross?
Sure. Sibby, I'm just going to get into a personal story because that I was inspired to write Sibby based on my great-grandmother, who was actually in Milledgeville Asylum. And her story disturbed me so much when I was doing research about my family, because this is a woman who had 9 children in, I think, 13 years, maybe 14 years. And she lived in extreme poverty. Her husband was a bootlegger, and they traveled from state to state. They lived in like 5 different states over the course of 10 years. And just hearing all of those circumstances, it's no wonder that she was a little off, you know, because her life was chaos, basically. And she had an episode and was put in the asylum. I think she was not even 30 years old the first time. And she ended up being there for 15 years and died there. And she never got out, even though her family, her children, tried multiple times to get her out. And she just wasn't allowed. She wasn't given the all clear for whatever reason. And that just always really bothered me, which is why I ended up writing the character. And I wanted to put, something in the novel that kind of makes you wonder, is she actually mad? Or did she just have an understandable breakdown, as anyone would when presented with these circumstances? Just because my own great-grandmother's story bothered me so much, I just couldn't let it go.
Oh my gosh, yes. I mean, that's incredibly powerful, isn't it? That old adage that truth is stranger than fiction. A story like that, it's just so compelling and powerful that it needs to be told, and you certainly do it beautifully in Monarchs, Lila.
Thank you.
And of course, it's this whole notion of postpartum depression, which I think might have been sort of a common instigator of this kind of institutionalization. And of course, it's like the yellow wallpaper, the short story by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, where the narrator is isolated in a room in order to refrain from any kind of mental stimulation. And unsurprisingly, she becomes, goes quite mad and is convinced that there's a woman trapped in the yellow wallpaper in her room, symbolizing her own physical, intellectual, and emotional entrapment. And of course, the woman in the wallpaper doesn't literally exist, but figuratively, she represents all women of the period who were repressed by society. And I thought it was very interesting that in this short story, the woman has almost no voice. We don't even know her name, and only the reader is allowed to hear her thoughts. But as you're mentioning, Lila, the author, Charlotte Gilman herself, was suffering from postpartum depression when she wrote the story, and she went through an experience similar to that of her protagonist. And clearly, mental illness in women during this time was often dismissed as hysteria, and doctors commonly prescribed bed rest. And it's sort of representative of the powerlessness and repression of women during the late 19th century. So I ask you both, really, what has changed? I guess I'm asking in regards to the modern stigma associated with mental illness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was thinking about the way that in the Victorian age and through on up, even into the 50s and 60s, the so-called treatment was brutal. You know, they would have, like I have in my story, is they would use drugs that would make you vomit, make you basically purge. They would chain you up to the walls. They would give you cold baths, cold water treatment. In the 50s, we had shock therapy. We don't use a lot of those methods anymore, obviously, but there still is so much that is unknown about mental illness, and the treatments can be really sketchy even today. You know, medications may or may not work. Some mental illness, like schizophrenia, there isn't much of a treatment, and the stigma remains. So here in Canada, actually all over the world, but in Canada, we have universal healthcare. And you would think that you know, the mental health aspect of that would be taken care of, and it's just not. There's a huge link between mental illness and addiction these days. And we have the opioid epidemic. And along with that, mental illness, homelessness, and the opioid epidemic are all very closely linked. So this is, in my mind, this is a result of not offering the proper care for those that are experiencing mental illness. So the stigma is still there because now in my area of the woods, we're trying out supportive housing. And the problem with that, I mean, it's a great idea because you have people that are facing homelessness or are homeless or addicted. You get them into housing, you get them with supports, and they might have a fighting chance to overcome some of these issues. But the problem is the stigma of having one of these houses in a neighborhood is so strong that it's very difficult to place them around for people to use because nobody wants this in their neighborhood. So that's one of the main stigmas.
So it does seem that there's plenty of fodder for writing contemporary Gothic fiction, I suppose. It's regrettable. Obviously, that's a word is insufficient to describe it. But I guess you come back to the hope that the fiction writer can at least cast a light and illuminate some of the issues that are still so prevalent and so divisive in terms of marginalizing populations that lack access to housing or food security or such.
I wanted to ask a quick question about, Janie says, you know, is linking the writing of fiction as a way to shed some light on mental illness. And we're talking here about Gothic literature. And I wonder if both of you, we can start with you, Lila, if you have a favorite writer or a book that you feel has done that well.
That speaks to mental illness specifically in the Gothic genre? Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Oh gosh, I have so many. I'm not sure if many people would pick this, but I mentioned Erskine Caldwell before. He has a book called God's Little Acre that was written in the 30s, and I read it as part of my research for Monarchs. And he's considered a Southern Gothic author, but he's not as popular as, say, Flannery O'Connor or even Carson McCullers. But this novel deals with extreme poverty. And one might not assume that it's really about mental illness so much, but it's kind of there in between the lines, basically. All of these characters act so depraved and so outside of the norm. They've almost thrown off all social graces at this point because they're so hungry, so starving, so poor. And some of the scenes in this book would shock you at the way people are behaving, and especially for the 1930s, for it to be so shocking, some of the behaviors of these characters. It really was very stark for me and just really interesting the way that he wrote. And so that's one of my favorites for that reason. And then, of course, I also love, you know, Edgar Allan Poe, and Flannery O'Connor is a favorite, of course, and many, many others. But that one would probably be my top pick.
Great. What about you, Melanie?
Well, one of my recent favorites, I've just sort of discovered this woman in the last few years, is Angela Carter. I don't think she's Southern Gothic, but she, I guess, modern Gothic. I also really love Shirley Jackson. We always lived in the castle. It's so haunting. And I love the way that the narrator starts off one way and you think one way about the narrator, and then you later find out that she's the one that has the mental illness. I just love that, the way that she could switch that perspective. And of course, she does the same in The Lottery, where you're thinking, you know, it's one way, and then you're just completely sidelined when you find out, no, that's not what is happening. What is happening is far more darker.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes, I do. It is really interesting. And you know, there's Shirley Jackson, and then there's some even more contemporary writers. Michael McDowell, who wrote The Elementals, which takes place in the panhandle in Alabama. And I think even of Otessa Mushfeg, who's written some things recently, where there's just this, you're really never sure if it's the characters, if it's the character who is mentally ill, or if there are other forces at work, which to me is a bit of a mystery and makes such a great story. But thanks for sharing those, because, you know, I'm always looking for new things to put on my list.
Yeah.
It does seem like the common denominator in really well-crafted sort of Gothic literature, at least one aspect of it is the unreliable narrator. And obviously that's so magnificently portrayed in Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House and many other titles. And questions arise inevitably as to whether mysterious phenomena noted by the characters are actually paranormal in nature or whether they're the products of insanity. And I love that often the ultimate question is to whether mental illness is inherited and it runs in the family, and indeed whether one can escape destiny. And, you know, it's just tremendous narrative drama, really, that propels this sort of enthralling read forward. I mean, I recently discovered Haunting of Hill House and Shirley Jackson as well, Melanie. I hadn't read any of her works before, and I was riveted.
Yeah, for sure.
But I'm also really fascinated by the critical importance of place in Gothic fiction. And certainly in many contemporary versions of the genre, we've moved away from familiar themes such as ruined castles and helpless heroines and evil villains in order to situate the tropes of the supernatural and the uncanny within a recognizable environment. And this brings a sense of verisimilitude to the narrative, and thereby renders the Gothic features of the prose all the more disturbing. So in your book, Melanie, the parallel storylines are beautifully intertwined with Edward Walker's narrative set in 1865 and the anthropology professor Duncan Clark in contemporary London. The escalating terror of Walker's timeline is echoed precisely within Clark, and is all the more horrifying because it is a contemporary and highly familiar setting. And I was hoping that you might speak to your intent in regard to these dual timelines that depicts two men who are each, it seems, rapidly descending into madness, and the nature by which these timelines, one modern and one in the Victorian era, accentuate, intertwine, and reflect one upon the other.
Right. That dual timeline, I tell you, that almost drove me insane writing that. It was hard. It was difficult because I wanted to build up the tension in each story equally. So they're both sort of crescendoing at the same time. But the common theme that runs between the two characters is this zombie character who is originally found by Edward Walker in 1865. And by the time Duncan arrives at the scene, he does it through reading the journal. So Edward Walker is trying to discover why this child is behaving in this way. And he's trying to figure out how he can help him out of this. And at the same time, use him sort of as a scientific experiment into you know, the folklore and the culture of Haitian voodoo. So at the same time, Duncan Clark is trying to discover if this thing is real, and he has his own motivations and that he has an academic career to sort of to save. He's already sort of halfway down the rabbit hole in terms of his mental health. He's depressed and he has anxiety due in a large part to his recent divorce from his wife. So he's sort of floundering around. And when he finds this journal and he gets, you know, obsessed with this boy that once lived, or maybe he didn't live, he doesn't know what this. So that is fueling his obsession. And the same goes with the original character, Edward Walker. He is also dealing with an obsession of trying to discover what is wrong with this boy and figure this whole thing out. So to have the two working together, although one's in the past and one is our main viewpoint character, it sort of leads and plays into the whole thread of obsession going from one to the other. And another thing with the Gothic that I was reading about earlier is there's supposed to be a curse, some kind of curse in the story. And I didn't know that when I was writing this, because I had always thought that the zombie boy was the sort of curse. So anyone who gets involved in a heavy obsession with this boy.
So that it just begs the question to Lila and Melanie, you know, when you're researching all of the creepiness, do you find yourself a little bit nervous late at night at the typewriter, sort of glancing around in the dark?
I do, for sure.
Well, for me, what happened with me is I was looking up, because I have creepy curiosities all throughout this book. So in order to be able to describe them, I would do Google searches, you know, And I would look, I would find things I didn't want to see. And I would kind of be shocked and I'd have to leave the computer.
Oh, that's great.
It's so good. So I have a question. You've both written about characters, one with mental illness, one with an obsession, which seems to be anyone who comes in contact with the zombie boy is potentially cursed with this obsession. What is it that you want your readers to contemplate when they are reading about these characters? I guess we'll start with you, Lila.
With Civvy, I think I just really wanted people to consider, for women especially, what outside factors may be causing a person to act a certain way, what their trauma might be, what they're dealing with, what they're going through. And, you know, I just wanted to kind of tell that story of my great-grandmother, but also to just kind of bring it back to the forefront that you never really know what a person has dealt with, what they're dealing with. And that was really all it was for me. But also not only the character of Civvy, but that of OT and the other people around him as well. To get back to kind of stigma and things that were misunderstood back during that time, the character of Walt, for instance, is supposed to be autistic. And at least in Georgia during that time period, being autistic could get you thrown into Milledgeville as well, because there was no understanding of that. People didn't know what that even meant. They just thought a person was touched, as they call it. And then like for OT, who was dealing with, you know, an alcohol problem after the death of his family, that's another person, you know, addiction being misunderstood. And that's still true today. We were talking about how things have changed. Well, that's one area that really hasn't. We're still very judgmental of addicts, and we don't understand the science behind, the trauma behind addiction. And that was yet another thing that could get you put away. So I just kind of tried to bring all of these different things to the forefront and maybe start a conversation about the silent battles that people are dealing with and how back in those times, just the smallest little slip up could get you put away.
Right. Just develop some empathy around what characters might be going through and then somehow apply that to the world around you, which is great. And what about you, Melanie?
Well, for my story, I was interested in sort of the intentions of people and how intentions can go wrong. And we can get ourselves into a place where we've gotten so far down the path that we sort of box ourselves in with no way to like morally get out. How far do you follow an obsession? How much energy do you give it before you've put yourself in a really hard place and you have affected your relationships with others as well?
You know, it reminds me, Melanie, of when I spoke earlier about the sense of destiny. I really got that with Duncan in terms of his trajectory. It seemed almost like he was caught in a whirlpool that was ever stronger, pulling him down. I mean, and he tries to talk himself out of these decisions that he knows are bad. But as a reader, I always felt like he was struggling against the tide. Well, of course, the reader, you're aware of the other timeline and you know what he's moving toward. But it makes for incredibly compelling fiction because the whole time you're rooting for him. You're like, come on, Duncan, get out of this. You can do it. Make a good choice. But
yeah. Yeah, what's interesting about my two characters is they're both scientifically minded. So they're not likely to go straight to the supernatural. So they need some convincing. So that's sort of the way that they go down through. Like, this couldn't possibly be the supernatural because that's just not scientific. So then they have to come to a point where they have to start accepting that it is, which completely destroys their, you know, they get cognitive dissonance because of that. So that also contributes to the way that they start going downhill themselves.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the ways in which, you know, these conventions in Gothic literature, if I can call them that, really resonate today is that, you know, for example, literary madness shares with literal madness one terrifying similarity. It's often defined by comparing the behavior of the one suspected of madness with the behavior of those around them. So a diagnosis of madness in literature and in life may also be a vilification of difference, of poverty, and of desperate need. And I think that's a good thing to be aware of. If you'll allow me, because I endeavor to reference Dickens in every podcast episode, I'd like to read just a really short graphic description that he wrote upon visiting an asylum while he was in New York in 1842. So here's Dickens. The moping idiot, cowering down with long, disheveled hair, the gibbering maniac with his hideous laugh and pointed finger, the vacant eye, the fierce, wild face, the gloomy picking of the hands and lips, and munching of the nails. There they were all, without disguise, in naked ugliness and horror. Unquote. So to me, reading this, I thought, you know, madness in this instance, as Dickens saw it, was synonymous not only with the natural stresses to the human mind that would seem inevitable given long periods of incarceration, but were also clearly inspired by this dreary, dirty, ill-ordered conditions in which these individuals were kept. And what I was thinking about when Lila brought up the vilification of poverty and difference, wherever that stems from. And I think it's interesting because we do have a tendency to assume that these kinds of, you know, pejorative assessments really are a part of our past history without really recognizing the stigma we associate in the present time. So there's my little Dickens. Thank you for obliging me.
Fantastic.
So one quick question I've got for you both. An interesting aspect of Anne Radcliffe's fiction, I referred to her earlier as being one of the great precursors of Gothic fiction. She was criticized by Coleridge, of all people, for a certain timidity because the mysteries of her novels invariably have natural, if complicated, explanations. You know, her supernatural mysteries didn't sort of eventuate to be anything other than what could be eventually explained. She demonstrated, I believe, however, Gothic truly came alive in the thoughts and anxieties of her characters, and that Gothic, in that sense, has always been more about the fear of the supernatural rather than the supernatural itself. So I'd like to ask you both about how the internal monologue of your characters and their, you know, their sort of hidden anxieties really propel the momentum of your novel forward. Lila, would you like to start?
Sure. That's interesting because I remember writing Monarchs and I wanted to put a little Easter egg in there, just an allusion here or there to a possible ghost that haunts Civi. And I remember you and I talking about that a little bit and how heavy-handed I should be. And we decided not to be very heavy-handed because it's a little more creepy that way. And you wonder, is she just imagining that or could it be possible? And that's interesting because I think that is what makes some of my favorite books. My favorite writer is Stephen King, or my favorite modern writer, I should say. And I feel like he does that pretty deftly. Just the anxieties, the neurosis, the psychological trauma that people go through. And one thing I love to say about him is that the monsters aren't what's really scary in his books. It's the underbelly, the vulnerabilities of his protagonist. And all of his characters, while fighting said monsters, are really fighting their own trauma, their own childhood, their own pain. And that's why I love him so much. But I think that's true of good Gothic literature as well. Like, you know, these, it's not the monsters that's really what is scary. It's the conditions that people are living in, the trauma that they're dealing with, and so on.
Yes, of course. And Melanie, your characters as well are going through that same process. And one of the things I find really evocative about Peculiar Curiosity is similar to Dracula. It's narrated through first-person perspective and through journals and things like that. So you really get a powerful insight into the anxieties that are felt by the two men who are your protagonists. The reader can really get into their minds. Melanie, I don't know if your book could really have been done so effectively in any other perspective. I think the first person was really a super choice. Was that quite a deliberate one from the outset when you were writing your novel, or did that evolve over time?
Yeah, I do like the first person because you can really get into their minds, and it's way easier to do like an unreliable narrator because you don't know if you know, what is actually happening in the world, especially with Duncan, because he perceives his daughter has really good intentions towards him, but he's sort of suspicious of why do you want me to do this? Why are you bothering me to, you know, be, you know, engaged with you? And I'm busy on other things, you know, so he kind of has his own perspective. And so does Edward Walker, in that, again, he is obsessed. So his outside world, what's happening with his wife and his child, and he's sort of a bit shaded from that. So,
Lila, you wrote vividly about Milledgeville Asylum. And Melanie, your scenes of Victorian London were superlative. Did you each visit these locations in which you set your narratives, or were they based primarily on online research?
For me, I have been to Milledgeville Asylum many a time. It's only about an hour and 15 minutes away from my house. So I make it a point to go every summer, which I haven't been able to go this time around because of the pandemic. But I've been quite a few times, and I've tried to make it a point to visit different places there every time I go, because it spans over many miles. It's a huge, huge complex of buildings. So yeah, I went there many times for research, and I've gone many times since. I love to go there, actually. I feel a kinship with the place.
Yes, and that's clear from your work. Is it currently a museum, or what is its current status?
It was a museum for a short amount of time. They have closed it down because I think they said it has asbestos and it's not safe at the moment, which you can see just from looking in the windows. I mean, it's falling apart. I don't think they have any government funding to restore it at this point. It's very dangerous. They advise you not to go in, and just walking around the grounds, you'll have a security guard come up and ask you what you're doing. There's been a lot of vandalism and stuff there as well. So it's not currently a museum. However, it has been in the past, and I'm hoping that in future they'll get that done, because it's a beautiful landmark for Georgia. And it's been used in a number of different things over the years. I believe some of the Walking Dead TV show was filmed there. They filmed movies there. There's been other books and things written about it. So it's definitely in our cultural awareness here in Georgia. But as of right now, it's just kind of standing there open to the elements, just sort of abandoned, which is a real shame.
So other than historic architecture, do you think that the building itself is imbued with a sense of horror and foreboding? I mean, does that impede efforts for conservation? I mean, are there positive associations from that building in terms of the county and the wider state?
Yes, it has kind of a reputation outside of Georgia and Milledgeville as being a scary place. You know, it's on a lot of lists online of like the scariest asylums in the United States and things of that nature. And because of The Walking Dead and, you know, filming other things there that have been like scary movies and TV shows, it has a bit of a reputation. But I think that people who live in Milledgeville and that have been there often will tell you that the vibe or the feeling that the place has is very different. There's no scariness there for me. I don't get feelings of horror or anything of that nature. It's a very sad place. The energy there, it sounds strange to say, but my husband agrees with me on this. When you walk onto the grounds, you almost feel a sense of gratitude, almost as if the place is happy you're here, you know? It's very lonely, very sad energy, but it's beautiful and stately, and just, if they restored it, it would just be something to behold. It really would.
And Melanie, how did you immerse yourself in Victorian era London?
I've always loved Victorian London. I've never actually been to London, but I did all my research through Google Maps, and going right down and walking around all the streets. And actually, I had a Facebook friend, or have a Facebook friend that I've had for many, many years. And when I picked a location for my book in the city, and I picked out, you know, the neighborhood that Edward Walker would lived in, when it came time to find some better readers, I shuffled the book along to this friend of mine. And when he started reading, he wrote to me, he said, I live in that neighborhood. And I was like, oh my goodness. So he was able to tell me if I got anything wrong or anything like that. And he helped me with some of my British expressions as well. So, but I hope to go there someday.
Great. Okay. Well, then I would like to invite each of you to read a excerpt from your novel, perhaps one that best illustrates the theme of today's podcast, mental illness in Gothic literature. Lila, do you have a section that you'd like to read for us?
Sure. Mine actually takes place in the asylum, and we're starting with Civvy getting ready for her day, where typically a nurse would come to the patient's room and tell them that it's time to get up and get moving. So that's where we're going to begin. Let's go. Nurse Burns opened the door and ushered Civvy out, following two paces behind. The corridor was filled with other patients, rushing back and forth from the communal bathroom, getting ready for their own days ahead. They passed the heavy wooden doors where the violent patients were held, twice as thick as the doors in Civvy's own wing, with revolving windows for dinner trays and heavy metal deadbolts. Civvy felt she understood the violent inmates, the ones who cut up and down their arms with whatever sharp thing they could get, the ones who lashed out and pummeled the faces of the nurses who tried to hold them down, the ones who smashed the windows and tried to climb out, the ones who pinched pins from clipboards and butter knives from the kitchens and hid them in their thin mattresses, waiting for an opportunity, the ones who beat their heads on the wooden floors over and over again until they had to be transported to the Jones building. Civvy understood them all, understood that all that stood between civilized behavior and madness was the will to please others. Once you succumbed to being well and truly alone without a care for how others perceived you, once you'd been shown enough times that you did not matter, the will to please disappeared and the descent into madness began. They entered the elevator and the door shut behind them. The loud whir as they descended was a comfort to Civvy, who did not like silence. Things lurked in silence. "Patient Shelnut," Nurse Burns asked, "do you know when this hospital was built?" "Why," Civvy said, surprised, "if I recall correct, ma'am, it was in 1842. "Yes, I believe it was." "I'm surprised you know that," the nurse said flatly. "Do you have lessons here?" "No'm," Civvy said, "but I do read to pass the time when I'm allowed." "I see," the nurse replied. "So the place is quite old, was built even before the war. Did it have slaves?" "I can't say I know the answer to that, ma'am," Civvy replied. "Pretty likely, I expect." "I'll have to find out." The nurse gave her a chilling smile. "I can tell you for certain, though, it does have ghosts. I've seen them. There's one in your room." The elevator doors opened, and without another word, Nurse Burns strode down the hallway. Civvy stared after her a moment, then forced her legs to move, walking towards the kitchens. She didn't know if Nurse Burns was insane, deranged, or just plain out mean, maybe all three. But there were ghosts. Civvy had seen them, too. Then there were the spirits of people who had died in this place, who had never gotten out, to whom the cold, damp walls of Milledgeville Asylum had become home, those who had merged with the place, who had become the bones and brick and mortar. The old asylum reminded Civvy of a skull, dirty windows overgrown with ivy, peering at passerby like lidded eyes, straight, narrow steps like crooked teeth, the wide door, a gaping mouth ready to swallow a person whole, while the dead slept beneath the stately pecan trees, they also, Civvy knew, lingered within the asylum walls. The chapel was gloomily ominous, the kitchen full of eerie metal clangs, the hospital a clinical detached study in terror. Civvy often saw the ghosts while in solitary, fitted out in the strong dress, the sleeves tied behind her, unable to use her arms and unwilling to use her legs. She would lie down, playing possum, afraid to move, afraid to breathe. The dead were rarely fooled. They crept into her head and in sweet, coaxing voices told her things, reminded her of memories she'd rather forget. Folks on the outside might be surprised at just how many patients had managed to shift off the mortal coil while wearing a strong dress. It did not surprise Civvy. She'd tried it herself once. She shuddered, recalling one occasion when she'd managed to loop both arms of the strong dress around her neck, dislocating her shoulder in the process. "Well, you've got yourself into a right mess," the nurse had scolded her, drawn finally by the sounds of her screams. "But since you're just fine, perhaps you ought to stay that way for a spell, teach you a lesson." The nurse had turned out all the lights and locked her in. Several hours in solitary, in so much pain she screamed till her throat was raw, rats scrambling across the floor beside her. In recent years, Civvy had reached a shaky kind of peace with the asylum, a sort of willing blindness. She threw herself into her work and became adept at the art of willful ignorance. "I see nothing. I hear nothing. I am nothing." Whenever the light started to creep into the windows of her mind, faint tendrils of hope emerging from a long, joyless winter, she'd shut the sashes tight and block it out. Civvy found that if she steeled herself rigorously enough, she could block out all manner of hope and all manner of evil. A lot of the time it worked, except for when it didn't.
Wow. That's That's incredibly powerful.
Yes, that was amazing. Thank you so much.
And even more so as an author, I would imagine, sort of feeling like you're writing your relations experience. Your grandmother. Sorry, was it your grandmother, Lila?
My great-grandmother, yes. Actually, now that I'm saying it, now that I'm actually going back through my genealogy, I believe it was actually my great-great-grandmother. So it would have been my grandma's grandma. Yeah, so that was her experience, or at least how I assume it might have been. And another interesting anecdote about her, from what I've heard, one of the reasons that they didn't want to let her out, at least according to family rumor, was that she was such a good cook. And she worked in the kitchens and was very beloved because she had such a sweet disposition and she liked to walk outside among the pecan trees. And when my grandma's mom and her husband tried to get her out, they were told, you know, just put off constantly. And they always thought that it was because she was such a good cook and because they worked her to the bone all the time in the kitchens. So that's one of the reasons why I kind of tried to put that in the book also.
Melanie, do you have an excerpt from A Peculiar Curiosity you'd like to read for us?
I do. It's interesting that Lila mentioned rats, because that's where I'm going to be reading from mine. Yeah, so Duncan Clark, part of his anxiety is caused by this incredible rat mouse problem he has in his house. So I burst through the front door, ran to my study, and flicked on a lamp. From the top of the typewriter box, a shadow launched itself across my desk and disappeared behind Walker's crates. The ink sketch of Henri in its wooden frame clattered to the floor, breaking the glass. "You goddamn vermin! Tampering with my evidence, are you? Well, not today!" I exploded in rage. Pouncing on the crates, I dragged them across the floor, and the mouse, now exposed, bolted to the other side of the room. I clambered over the crates, grabbing at the rodent, which shot from my fist, ricocheted up my sleeve, and launched itself off my shoulder. I tried to smash it under my shoe, but it was too fast, fleeing behind my desk. Gripping the corner, I wrenched the desk away from the wall as the tip of the mouse's tail disappeared into a tiny hole in the baseboard. Dropping to my stomach, I peered at the hole, which was no bigger than the pad of my index finger. Amazing what a mouse could fit through. With a snarl, I realized my mistake. I'd been seeking larger crevices. Retrieving a hammer from the garage, I returned to my study and knocked out the wall around the hole that had swallowed my little friend. An odd sensation of glee crept across my heart, and I imagined a legion of tiny furry dead bodies and an end to the sleepless nights and constant squeaking and rustling irritations. Crawling along the floor, I bashed holes in the base of the wall at the various intervals. There would be no more hiding. I'd lay bare every access point, every hideaway, and then fill the walls with snapdraps. I went from room to room, smashing holes in the wall, discovering mouse shit, torn paper, food piles, and urine-soaked wood. Racing upstairs to my room, I pulled all the furniture from the walls and got down on my knees, hammering holes to expose all their secret places. In Clara's old bedroom, I pulled out the bed, dresser, and night tables, smashing above the baseboards until my hands wrung with the tension and sweat dripped from my brow. "You're dead, you sodding bastards," I whooped. Mice scurried behind the disintegrating wall, fleeing in all directions, dodging my flailing hammer. At last, with heartbeat thundering in my chest and not a mouse in sight, I dropped the hammer. Now that the framing was exposed, my house smelled strongly of mice and their filth. Storming to the kitchen, I grabbed a jar of peanut butter and a spoon. I baited the spring-loaded traps and then thrust them into the holes I had created. My sweat-soaked hair tumbled across my brow. The sharp chime of the doorbell broke my concentration. Bugger, what was it now? Maybe if I didn't answer it, they would go away. The bell rang again. Reluctantly, I opened the door to find Diane on the threshold, all dimpled and red-cheeked and smelling like Chanel. My stomach flopped at the unexpected sight of her. Her fixed smile dropped into bewilderment when she saw me. "Duncan, I came round to see if I could get my clock." Her eyes focused on my forehead, eyebrows knitted together. "What on earth is that on your head?" I brought a hand to my head and felt a greasy smear of peanut butter, suddenly aware of how terrible I must look, and with her and her red lipstick and coiffed hair. I stepped back into the hall and muttered, "Come in." Diane followed and shut the door behind her. Duncan, I... Good God, what's gone on here? Her eyes widened at the sight of the lounge, the destruction, the mess, the smell. The exterminators. They make a wreck of things, but at least they are thorough. This is dreadful, Diane exclaimed. Now, I don't know much about exterminators, but I would think that... No reason to think, Diane. I've done all that. So I see. Look, Duncan, Clara is worried about you. She says she's been calling and leaving messages, but you haven't returned them. She's told me you aren't doing very well. I needed my clock, so I thought I'd come around and see for myself. Are you okay? Her concern disarmed me, and my heart darkened with the sting of cynicism that this beautifully put-together woman, whom I had loved and lost due to my own ineptitude, would show me any compassion now. I'm fine. Why does everyone ask me that?
Both the ex-wife and the daughter serve as such perfect foils for Duncan's descent into incoherence and chaotic madness. And of course, when Diane arrives at the door, it's perfectly evident that Duncan's response to the mice infestation is wildly sort of out of control. But you do also wonder, are the mice real? Are the mice real? Because I don't know if Diane or Clara really see them either. So that whole notion of an unreliable narrator and Duncan's descent into some kind of craziness is also marvelously foreshadowed.
Yeah, and I think it's great too that he's smashing up his house in order to get rid of the mice, and instead of just putting traps out. So talk about obsession. I think it's great. So good.
And it does illustrate so beautifully, you know, the collapse of his entire life around him, you know, where he is his own worst enemy, attacking and destroying and demolishing, you know, the very structures that shelter him and nourish him, you know, his house, his relationships with his family, because he is so driven by this overwhelming obsession with this boy, which is just so marvelously constructed, because we have a little bit more insight into what his destiny might turn out to be than he does.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I was thinking earlier, Walker has sort of a crumbling manner, but Duncan doesn't. And then when I read this, I'm like, oh yes, he does, doesn't he?
Yes. And he's kind of helping it along a little bit. Yeah. Wow. Well, this has been an incredibly fun discussion. I really, really appreciate your time, Lila and Melanie, to be with us today.
It was so much fun to hear you both read from your own work, because I think it does add something in addition to the text. It just we get a nice feel for your characters and what they're going through. And it's been wonderful to chat with you both. And thanks for spending an hour with us this afternoon.
And for those listening in, Monarchs Under the Sassafras Tree and A Peculiar Curiosity can be purchased on our website at www.regalhousepublishing.com. And indeed, the very best way to support any indie press is to buy books directly from their website. And we at Regal House are most grateful for your support. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider leaving us a review. We'd love to hear from you. And we hope that you will join us for our next episode on A Conspiracy of Lemurs, The Road to Redemption, Landscape, Culture, and Catastrophe as Catalysts for Character Development, with Rebecca Baum and Carol Hoffner. From all of us at Regal, keep reading.